You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Hi, everyone. My guest today is Nikki Masood. She is a talented actor and writer based in New York City. We met maybe 4 years ago or so. Because of the podcast, we were both randomly at a friend's film screening. I was talking to the person next to me, and Nikki was seated in front of me and turned around because she recognized my voice from listening to The Compass and introduced herself. So I've been following her career since then. I'm so excited for everything she has going. She's about to be performing as an actor in a new play at Playwrights Horizons called Wish You Were Here, so please check that out. And you can also look up her website, nikkimasood.com, to see what she has going on. I hope you enjoy the 182nd episode of The Compass. Well, I always start with the same question, which is, what do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
I think the easiest way to tackle that question is to say what the dark side is first, and then kind of, because it can be so many things. I think for me, when I think about all of the different things that like keep me up at night and make me anxious and get me angry and get me scared, it all comes down to one thing, which is time. The feeling that I am running out of time, the feeling that my time is being wasted, the feeling that my time is not within my control, the feeling that I'm behind because I, you know, those people are ahead of me. What was I doing? I should have this, this, and this done by now. It always has to do with time. And I feel like during the pandemic, one thing that I kind of realized was that I think time is the most precious resource that we have, actually. Like, we spend so much of our lives worrying about money and, you know, like people and all these other things that obviously matter. But if you don't have time, none of that is important. So there's something about, and I feel like there were times when we were in the middle of, you know, our version of lockdown, where people wanted time to go by faster. People talk about killing time, which is such a violent thing when you think about like killing time. And like, it's so, it's wrong. You know, people will be like, you know, I have friends who will be like, well, I'm really 30 because those 2 years don't count. And I'm like, no, those 2 years do count. They have to count. And so, yeah, I think a lot of my like darkness comes from my relationship to time, and the way that I kind of deal with that is, I think like by doing things that feel like there are little nuggets of things that I can do that I feel like make me feel like, oh, I got something done today, or I did something that made me feel better. Like, I don't know, cleaning, weirdly. Like, I'm like, I cleaned the bathroom today. That's an accomplishment,
well,
right?
It's or something like, that you can actually tangibly see.
Exactly, yes. And it makes you feel better, right? And like, or I changed my sheets, or you know, and it doesn't cost anything, right? And then once you've done it, even if it's like one small thing, like you dusted a shelf, you look at it and every time you see it, you feel better because it's, you know, something about your physical surroundings has changed. I also love like going for a walk, going outside to Prospect Park, because luckily I live so close. And like, there's something about kind of trees and birds and dogs and like small kids. Like there's something about being around all of that that makes me feel like, even if it's only half an hour, it feels so, it changes your relationship to time. There's something about it that just makes time feel softer and more nourishing, I think.
I think that is one of the things that's made the pandemic so tough, is that we, for a lot of us, we're just stuck in one place.
Yeah.
For whole days at a time. And I think part of the way that we mark time is those different places we need to go throughout the day. And that schedule that also changes location.
Yeah.
That's so interesting that you articulate that as the thing that you deal with the dark side, that it's all about time. Do you feel like most of it is kind of the different deadlines that society puts on us? Or is it kind of your own feeling of like, the time is passing and I want to make the most of it?
It's hard to know which is which, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really hard to know. I mean, some of it for sure, like career stuff is definitely nonsense. Like the career stuff, like, oh, you have to book this kind of job by this age or you're not a real, you know, artist, not a real actor. Or not.
Well, especially as a woman too, there's like the undercurrent that if it doesn't happen by this age, it's not going to happen because of all of the sexist yes. ideas out there.
Yes, which is one thing that makes me feel like better about the state of humanity right now is seeing so many women who are quote unquote past the, you know, I don't know if you've seen that like Julia Louis-Dreyfus sketch. I think it was SNL where she's celebrating her birthday and they're like, it's her last fuckable day. And
yeah.
She's like, I don't know if we're allowed to say that sure. on the podcast. But, you know, like she's eating the cake and they're like, after this day, no sex ever again. but like, there are so many women who are past that totally fake deadline who are just like killing it. Just, you know, absolutely like Olivia Colman is just like, you know what I mean? Like there are so many women who are doing that. And that makes me really happy. But I do think here's where I struggle is, I think if you're a woman and having a family is important to you and having like a child biologically is important to you, that is a deadline that is real kind of, because it is also economic, you know, which is
totally
tricky, right? Yeah. Because, you know, I think if you're independently wealthy, then you can kind of have a kid at any time and have a full-time nanny and know that that kid will have health insurance and a home. And, you know, you can divide that, cause it's labor, you know, like it's real labor. And like, I think, or if you're, you know, if you're a woman who can afford to freeze her eggs, if you're a woman mm-hmm. who can afford a surrogate, like all those things change your relationship totally. To that. But if you do not have the money to do that, if you do not have the resources to do that, then that deadline is real for you. And I think part of the career panic comes from like, okay, well, if I haven't made it to a certain point before I have this kid, then I'm going to have this kid. And then I'm going to be like sleep deprived. I'm going to have this huge other priority. And like people will also treat me poorly, especially in our industry, because like, you know, I mean, you hear all these crazy stories about like, you know, Carrie Perloff having to like hide her baby in another room while she was breastfeeding because Harold Pinter didn't want to, like, you know what I mean? Like you hear these stories and you're like, how did women do this? So, you know, I think that the career panic and the biological deadline are related, unfortunately. And I also think they all go back to the problems of capitalism. So
we solved everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Done and done.
yeah, just It really is true, though. I mean, like, I have family on my mom's side who immigrated to France. And, like, I remember going to visit and, like, you know, this woman, like, worked at a perfume counter. But, like, she knew that her child had health insurance. Every day she dropped this baby off at the creche, which was, like, a beautiful, clean, well, like, staffed, state-run daycare. Like, that would completely change your
relationship. That she could afford on the job she was working.
Yeah, because it was the government. Like, because they, you know, I think that just completely changes your feelings around deadlines.
Totally.
When you know that.
Okay, there's so many things I want to talk about. How are you feeling at this moment? I want to know how you've been doing through the pandemic, but also just talking about time. I'm curious if you're feeling like you're leaning a little more towards, like, the grind at the moment, or if you've I know people have been talking a lot about kind of rediscovering the importance of rest and, like, giving that importance. And I'm leaning more on that side at this point. Where are you feeling pulled right now? Are you feeling driven towards multitasking, tasking, or, like, driven towards balance?
So I think what's tricky is that I never really had, I guess there were a few months at the beginning, maybe 6 months, where first 3 months of the pandemic, I was fortunately trapped with my, like, drama school classmates who are, like, my friends of, like, 10 years. We've been roommates in New York for a long time and we really trusted each other. And so, like, sorry about the street noise. But then after that, there were 3 months when I was back home with my family in Maryland. And at that point, throughout that, I was sort of starting to record audiobooks in, like, my closet, in, you know, whatever insulated fake, you know, booth space I could find. And I was tutoring online and I was writing my first play. So there's a level on which I was kind of multitasking in the way that I think everybody was to some extent. Like, I think many people, even when they were trapped at home, were multitasking because, you know, even if your tasks weren't, like, go to 5 appointments and then see a play and pick up, you know, like, I think you were still kind of, you know, it was things like who's going to the grocery store and, like, how do we, you know, does that make sense? Like, I feel like the multitasking unfortunately never stopped.
Right. The mental weight was always there.
Right. And, like, even if you spent a whole day scrolling on your phone, which I think parents really couldn't. And, you know, it was things like cooking. It was things like unloading the dishwasher. It was things like, you know, like, there's always some noise. And the money anxiety and all of that, like, I almost feel like, I'm not being very articulate right now, but, like, when we were in isolation, I feel like there was always a noise for me. I tend towards anxiety. I tend towards anxiety. Like, they say, you know, you either tend towards anxiety or depression, and I tend towards anxiety.
Me too.
And so there was this just buzzing, and it was a quieter buzzing when we were in lockdown, right? But there was always this, like, worry about something, keep on top of something, check the news, you know, like, are you... And then as things opened up, as things got more quote unquote normal, the buzzing got louder. But I never feel like the buzzing really stopped. And for some people, I feel like, anyway, so that's, I feel like I'm not really answering your question. right now, what I feel is that I am multitasking, but I am very protective of my boundaries, and I'm more protective of my boundaries than I've ever been in my entire life. So, like, this was really the first time where I'm sort of meeting with writers reps, you know, agents and managers. And like, this is the first time in my life that I was like, I'm not responding to that email that you sent on a Saturday. And on Monday morning, I'm going to email you and say, the best time to email me about business is during the week. Like, I mean,
good for you.
Never before. Like, if you sent me like a self tape on Saturday night, I would be like, yes. like, how many takes do you want? I'll like, you know what I mean? Like, and it's just like, I do find that very hard to deal with, to be honest, like the whole self tape culture.
Well, there it's talking about time. There's that pressure built into it of like, you have to get it in this amount of time. You don't have enough time to really memorize it. Like pressure, pressure.
Well, and like, what's cool is that there are these hacks that people have figured out, you know, like people have like, they're like, oh, I've got a like little teleprompter where like my partner like scrolls down on the laptop and I'm just reading the lines of the, you know, like there are people who figured out how to kind of do that, which is very cool. But I have never been good at that. Like, I've always needed to sort of integrate the lines. And I don't know if you saw, there was this announcement that in the UK, they've now changed the rules so that you can only, like, if you expect to tape back within 3 days, it can only be a certain number of pages.
I saw that. Yes. I think that's a great rule.
I think that is such a great rule. And the same was, they were like, if it's more than 7 pages, it has to be this number of days. Like, they made these rules. And I was like, this would be life-changing. This would be so life-changing. And I also think like I developed a perhaps unique hatred for it during the pandemic because I'm single. And so like, even when I was living with my parents and my brother, it was torture. Like, it was so like silly being like, and we've all done it and I will undoubtedly do it again, but like getting my brother to like read with me on a commercial tape or something, like, right. Just so silly.
Or when you, like, you have to keep calling people for the favor. Yeah.
Oh, it's so, and it's a pandemic. So you're asking them to expose themselves, or you're doing it on Zoom, which I'm like, this is so gross. Cause like, you can't, you're not like breathing with the person. The timing is off. You don't see their body language. Like, all these things that they taught us in school are just off the table. And I think all the time, Leah, about how people book things. And I'm like, that's also your scene partner. And like, your scene partner is often your life partner. Like, how many people do we know where I'm like, listen, like, your partner, the second you got this tape, dropped everything they were doing and made as many takes as you needed.
It's definitely dedication.
Yes. And like, you gave you outfit notes. And like, I truly believe I'm always very keen on like congratulating the partner whenever that happened. I'm like, this is also your accomplishment. Good job. You know?
I mean, as someone who's married to another actor, I will say that like, if in just the supportive partner way, it's a win for both of us. But there's also that like dedication of knowing how much it takes as an actor and helping with the tape and knowing how invested we both are in it, that I definitely take that as a win for both of us when Frankie books something.
It is. It is objectively a win for both. It was a team, like, it was a team enterprise. And I think it should definitely be treated that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just like, you know, I think too often we buy into this narrative of like, oh, this like one person is a shooting star. And I'm like, I mean, they are, but there's usually a community of people around them who are making that possible for them.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, how wonderful for both of you also to have like a scene partner who like knows you so well, is beautifully trained, like knows how to give you notes, right? Like in a way that you very will like handy. Receive them. Yeah, it's a real gift.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
So wait, you just wrote your first play during lockdown?
Yeah.
Have you been were you a writer like in different forms before that?
Well, I mean, I did. Our program included playwriting classes, which was very cool.
Right. Brown Trinity, everybody listening, right?
Yes. That MFA program always had both directing training and writing training, which I think is really important. And I think that all actors, that should be part of any MFA. So, you know, we did that. And then I was always somebody who kept a journal and I, you know, wrote bad poetry and, you know, but that was something where, you know how people used to ask you, like, what's your hobby? And you'd be like, I'm an actor. I have no hobbies. Exactly. Like, everything I do feeds my art. But, like,
I also have no time for anything else.
Exactly. I'm like, when in this 18-hour day of rehearsing and classes and whatever do I have time? But there is this, like, thing of, oh, I have something that is not commercial. I'm not selling it. No one will ever see it. It just belongs to me. And so I did have that in the form of my journal for many years. And I think I took, you know, like a workshop with Heather Raffo at CUNY, like a writing workshop with her. But in general, I just didn't think of myself that way. And basically what happened is that I was reading submissions for the Coop. You know how they have people like, like read all of the, and of course everyone was submitting their plays because it was the summer of 2020 and everyone had written a play. And so my job was to read the play, write a report on it, like summarize it, and then like either recommend that the next person up the ladder read it or not. And I'm reading these submissions and at some point I was like, you know, that maybe mine is not so bad because some of these are like, some of them were amazing, but some of them were like really rough. So I was like, well, maybe I can just, you know. So I sent it to them and then that was it. Like we started sort of Zoom workshopping it.
This was the one that you had written during lockdown or had you started this back at school?
This was one where I think the idea had sort of been cooking for a while and maybe I had a scene, but then lockdown happened and it was the combination of lockdown and the protests happening. Because at this point I was in this small town called Bethesda outside DC. It's like 20 minutes drive from, you know, the city. And the protests were happening. They were fully happening. And I mean, both of my parents are like, my dad was sick and my mom like is a cancer survivor. Like I really wasn't in a position where I could put them at risk by going out into big crowds and like, but I was so, you know, I was reading and talking and thinking about this and I was sitting in this suburb. By the time I was in high school, we had ended up in this like middle-class model minority suburb. And I was thinking so much about the model minority myth that we are raised on. Mm-hmm. This idea of like, well, you know, if you are educated enough and your English is perfect and you adhere to certain beauty standards and you follow these, you know, like if you do all these things, then you will be safe. And so I was taking stock of and thinking about these ways in which many quote unquote model minorities align themselves with white supremacy, become complicit in white supremacy, in upholding it because of this effort, this desire for safety. And I was taking classes. Ceci and I both had wanted to do some workshops with Haruna Lee, with this amazing like writer and teacher, specifically for non-Black people of color and like to talk about what our place was in this movement. Because on the one hand, we were like, well, our voices are not actually, like, we do not need to be yelling. We should be amplifying other people. But on the other hand, there was this thing of like, well, we have to take a responsibility for like anti-Blackness in our own communities. We have to deal with, you know, our own colorism, our own internalized race, you know, like all these things. And so between all of that, you know, I just trapped in my room on my computer all the time, I felt like I had to write. I was just compelled to do it.
That's amazing. But right now did you get a fellowship at the Atlantic? Is that what you're doing now with your writing?
So basically I got a City Artist Corps grant last summer. And so I was able to have my first in-person workshop of this play. And of course, hilariously, the City Artist Corps is like, you have to spend this money in 2 months. So, and you're like, I can't, like, no director is available for the next two months. Like, they're all booked right now. And like all these actors were, you know, it was fall of 2021 when things were getting going. And so I was like, okay, I can get everything we want for one day. Everyone we want for one day. And all the studios are also, it's so depressing. Like all of the Simple Studios closed, Shetler Studios closed. All of these places we would normally book to rehearse and practice are closed, with the exception of Ripley Greer and 440 Studios, which is only open on weekends. And of course, all these people were only available on a Monday. So, so we ended up doing the play at Ripley Greer, and like following COVID guidelines, you know, we had to be in like a space of a certain size and only have a certain number of seats. And it just so happened that Abby Katz from Atlantic knew my director, Perone Yousafzadeh. She was invited. She happened to be free on a Monday night and she came to the reading. And so that was the beginning of this relationship with Atlantic. And that was how I ended up getting the commission.
Amazing. That's so exciting.
Thank you. I mean, it was definitely, I feel very lucky that it worked out that way. You know, and I don't know. I mean, I do think it is an example of the community being so important, like the fabric of our community, because that is, I didn't know Abby. Like the only reason that happened is because of this, you know, friend and this collaborator that I had. And what I feel is that when we were in lockdown and over the past 2 years, our community has become like a sweater that's sort of stretched out, you know, the knit with like the holes being bigger, and like maybe some of the connections have snapped, and you know, and what I'm feeling right now is it's almost like we're in the dryer and like it's sort of shrinking back together a little bit, but it's in a funny shape, like there are bumps, and you know what I mean.
I love this analogy.
It's, you know,
I miss it so much. I honestly, like, we've still been being very, very cautious since our daughter can't be vaccinated yet. And I just miss seeing people. It's been virtual for so long.
It's so hard.
And you know the community is still there for you.
Yeah.
But it isn't tangible.
No, I think that, you know, parents of tiny humans have really... y'all are champions, and it has been really unfair, you know, the way that I mean, we could talk about that all day, obviously, but you know, I think that, you know, I'm so grateful. Like, I'm so grateful that you're like, you know, you made a person and you're keeping them safe. And like someday they're going to vote, and like, no. You know what I mean? Like that's
my job, but I do wish, I just wish there was a little bit more mindfulness about like the fact, I mean, again, we won't talk about this forever. The fact that these mask mandates are getting lifted right now, like probably a month before our kids can get vaccinated, is like, can't you just wait so these things can overlap just a little bit so that there's not even less places that I can take my kid because now nobody's wearing masks.
Yep. Yep. I mean, yeah. No, anyway. I mean, it's I completely agree. And I think that it's very funny to me that we are simultaneously having this conversation about the declining birth rate in most Western industrialized nations, but particularly in America. And I'm like, well, you know, maybe you should consider, you know.
There's always those articles that come out and I'm always like, yes, obviously, all of these things. But I do, I wonder, like, is the conversation happening? Is it ever getting above this certain level? Or is it just one of those things that's like, well, that's like so many things. That's a women's issue. Somehow it's just women.
It is remarkable that so many of those headlines are like, why are women deciding not to do this? And I'm like, well, first of all, last time I checked, it takes more than one lady to make a person. Last time I checked. And, you know, second, I'm like, well, I think there is this kind of, how do I put this? I mean, we have actually rarely been able to maintain our own population on the birth rate alone. Immigration was helping mm-hmm. us for a very long time, and now it's not because we have decided to, you know, restrict immigration more, even more than we have in the past. And I think that, I think the conversation is happening because, again, capitalism. Not, like, I just think there's this awareness of who's going to keep us all afloat after a certain point. And also real estate. I don't know if you saw, there was this amazing article in the Wall Street Journal about how all these boomers are, you know, with McMansions, for example, want to sell their homes. They want to sell their homes at a profit and they want to move to a nice little, you know, little apartment and have everything be more convenient. But they can't sell them because we are not buying them because we cannot afford them. And also we are not having babies.
I did not so, read this.
Yes, this is a real, and it's funny because there are people in the comments who are like, ugh, like millennials have no taste and like they have no desire for homes. I'm like, we are the people who are the market for HGTV. So that's nonsense. Like we love, like we are the people who like look at real estate porn. No, the reality is that, you know, I think there are a lot of, it would be one thing if these were all people saying, I choose not to have a child because there are other things in my life that are more important to me right now. And it's never something that I've ever wanted. It's never crossed my mind. That's one thing. That's perfectly right. Fine. But what we're seeing is actually many people reporting that they would like to have children, but feeling that they cannot afford them. And that is an entirely different problem. And it is that. It is a problem. I also think there's like a sort of shadow problem in that if you look at the stats, men are so ill-informed about their own fertility. Like I was working as a personal assistant to a woman who was doing research on this. And it turns out that if you look at men over 45, on average, it takes them, I hope this is all correct. I can like pull up the article and cite this, but like, you know, they're in this particular study, it took them four times as long to get a woman pregnant. And it's for sure that like your chances of miscarriages, your chances of birth defects, your chances of schizophrenia, these things go up as a man gets older, regardless of the age of the partner.
And we never hear about that. We
don't hear about that.
If the woman gets older.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And I think women from the time we're very young are constantly bombarded with this messaging about how we have this very specific timeline. But I don't think men have that message. They sort of assume that they can always find a younger partner and always do that later. And the reality is that that's not what's happening. It's harder and harder. And I think that's also doing a disservice to men. Because if you do want a child and that's a priority for you, then you should know that it would be best to make it happen if you can before a certain age, you know?
Interesting.
It is interesting. I mean, I also think so much of it is economic. Like, I think...
I think that's the biggest part. Yeah. Like you said, it just really is the biggest part. And it's hard to even fathom, since we live in New York City, that, like, it's on a different scale, but it affects everyone everywhere in the country. And, you know, it's just so extreme in New York that you're like, well, maybe it's only here. Maybe it's just because I choose to live in New York that things are so hard. But it's, you know, it's on just on a different scale everywhere else, because salaries are also not as high in other places, and everything's kind of to scale.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, I chose to be an artist. The thing of, like, I chose to be an artist instead of a doctor or an engineer. Exactly. It's my fault.
Yeah. What do your parents think about your choice to be an artist for your career?
It's a very complicated, ongoing conversation. I think, you know, like many immigrants, there's the thing, and not immigrants, actually, like, there is the thing of, like, can my child make a living? Like, is my child going to have security? I do think the immigration complicates it, in that you have this sense of, like, my parents sacrificed so much, which means that I have to achieve something, whatever that means, and somehow make that sacrifice worthwhile. So I was, like, always a kid who really loved storytelling and make believe, and, you know, lived in books, and I started out actually as a singer. I was in choir, and I did musicals, and I, you know, studied opera, and I applied for conservatories when I was, you know, at the right age. And basically, I also applied to the school where my dad taught, because I knew that if I got in there, I would be able to get, to, you know, free tuition, no debt. Right. And luckily, I got in there, which was really nice. And I also ended up getting callbacks to these music schools. So I went to these callbacks, and I did not do as well as I had hoped. I mean, part of it was just that, like, I'm a soprano, I'm a lyric soprano, which is a very common voice type. And I was going to many of these alone. And you see, like, you know, there are girls who, I mean, you must see this at Juilliard all the time. Like, even at such a young age, they're really seasoned. They've done music festivals. They know how to answer in interviews. Their moms are fluffing their dresses and spraying their hair.
They're very polished.
Yes. And I was not like that. And, you know, and they also knew that I was told from the beginning that I would have to have a full scholarship if I went to any of these schools. There was no way I would, you know. And so I ended up getting offered a scholarship for opera at my local state school. And it was a full ride, which was amazing, but it was not, you know, an Eastman. It was not an Oberlin. It was not. And my dad basically was like, if you do this, you want to make sure that you're really good at it. Because if you're not really good at it, then you will be eaten alive, basically. And so I believed that. At the time, I was like, well, yeah, I guess I just wasn't good enough. And I went to this liberal arts school, very good liberal arts school. And I just didn't touch a play. They didn't really have a music program. I didn't touch a play. I didn't touch any singing. I was pre-med, and I was miserable for the first semester, really miserable. And then I sort of, by accident, like, they were doing a bluegrass chamber opera called Wisconsin Death Trip. And I think they sort of folded me in because I could sing at the last minute. And from then on, I kind of became you know, a fixture in the drama department, which, and the theater at this school, because it's a political school in DC, was very politically oriented. So we got to see things like Belarus Free Theater, and, you know, like the civilians came. And I think when I was 19, I ended up getting a scholarship to go to BADA. You know how they have this summer program where you can go to Oxford, and mm-hmm. and I happened to be in a group with the most incredible people. They put me in the Chekhov group with like Chris Myers and Davine Joy Randolph and like this incredible. And so, and they were all in these great school, they were all in MFA programs, and they knew how to do all these cool things, and they knew about Beckett. And I was like, wow, like maybe. And whenever we had a day off at BADA, you could just book a private with the teachers. And so I just got to the point where like people were taking the Channel to Paris. And I was like, I have a private at 10, then I have a private at noon, then I have a private at 3. Like I was just like doing this all day. And at some point, someone was like, you know, I think you really like this. Maybe you should, maybe you should do this. James Bundy was one of my teachers, like, you know, all of that. And so from then on, I think I was like, okay, it's the theater, capital T. And, you know, I ended up, and my dad, again, my parents were like, well, now you have a liberal arts degree. So again, if you get a scholarship, if you get into the one of these schools, that's fine, as long as it doesn't, you know, put you into a ton of debt, because there was a lot of emphasis on that. And so, yeah, that was sort of how I ended up on this path. It's been very complicated. I mean, my dad has compared this profession to gambling, which it is.
It's not wrong.
It's not wrong. And he also has always felt for years that I should be a writer, which is very ironic to me because like writing is such a risky profession and like also makes no money.
Is he picturing it in a different format?
Yes. I think he's picturing it as like I have something. I think he's picturing it as I have a 9-to-5 job and then write the great American novel at night.
I think that's what he's thinking.
Because he himself is an academic who like writes books at night. Like that's what he did.
What does he teach?
He teaches psychology. It's all coming together.
Of course you ended up in the theater.
Yeah, absolutely.
You already have an interest.
Yes. It's very ironic because one of his most popular classes is the psychology of literature, and he teaches Hamlet and Jane Austen and like all these.
Oh my gosh.
You know, in that class.
And what does your mom do?
My mom is a scientist. So she is a biochemist. When I was a kid, she actually worked at the NIH. She was a researcher. And now she's a patent examiner. So, you know, she's the person stamping those patents. Also, there have been a lot of those during the pandemic. The same way that everyone has been like writing a play. Everyone was like, now is the time I'm going to invent something, which is cool.
That's really interesting. Parents. It's always so complicated.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, you're about to start rehearsals for a show. Is this your first show in 2 years since everything?
Yes. I mean, to be fair, this play was supposed to, Wish You Were Here is the play by Sanaz Tusi. It's a wonderful play. Mm-hmm.
And it's at Playwrights Horizons, is that?
It's at Playwrights Horizons. It's basically like, it's about our moms. So it's very personal. It's about like a group of Iranian women who are all kind of early 20s, right when the revolution happens in 1979. And it's really delightful because it's so different from the sort of grief porn woman crying in a hijab sort of, you know, it's like they're, you know, like it's joyful, it's funny, they're making like period jokes and, you know, like they're being like, you know, girls. And then basically what happens is the political, whatever it is very subtle. Over the course of the play, it gradually, you're like, oh, the Jewish one disappeared. One of them died. One of them escaped. Like you're watching this narrow down until at the end, there's only one left. Spoiler alert. Still come. It's so good. But anyway, it was supposed to be at Williamstown. It got canceled, pushed back and then canceled at Williamstown. And then we ended up recording a version of it for Audible.
Oh.
Which was cool. You know, we just like all got into our little blanket forts at home and they somehow rigged a recording of us. But yes, this is the first time I'll be doing anything. I also didn't book any television during the pandemic. There were some people who were so good about that. And, you know,
I think social media also made it seem like everybody was booking something. And it was actually like, no, it's still a pandemic. A lot of people have not worked.
Yeah. And, you know, I was lucky about the audiobook work that really kind of saved my butt. I was tutoring in person for probably too much of the pandemic and taking the train quite a long way, in some cases an hour and a half, to kind of get to my tutoring jobs. But the audiobooks really helped because, you know, it's just you alone in a room, you're isolated, you're very safe. Your biggest worry is like the noises that the rats are making in the wall or the washing machine, or like, is your neighbor on the stairs? Is the dog barking? You know, stuff like that.
That's great. Well, so excited about that play. I want to come see it.
Oh, please do. Yes.
Are you feeling all excited, or is there a little bit of like residual nervousness of like, what is it like to be in a rehearsal room again?
Well, I am excited because I really love the group that's working on the show. Like, I'm so excited to see those women every day. It's like G.T. Upchurch and like all these wonderful Iranian actresses. And, you know, I'm excited about that. But I will admit I am nervous in that, you know, prior to this, if I got sick with COVID, I live alone. I record alone in a booth. No one's going to get hurt. No one's going to lose money. No one's job is compromised. Mm. I think what worries me is like with a play like this, as I'm sure you've seen, like there are so many plays that have been delayed or, you know, canceled because of people getting sick. And obviously there's also the safety, you know, you don't want to, you know, God forbid you like infect the costume designer who infects her husband who's immune compromised, you know, like all of that. But I am nervous about that. Artistically, I am not as nervous because fortunately I am like a fun supporting character. Like I'm not in every scene. I'm not carrying the play, which is sort of ideal. And I don't know. I am also a little bit nervous about like finding time to write because, you know, it's 6 days a week and you know how it is when you're in a process like that, you want to be like researching and thinking about it and, you
it's
know.
It's going to be a big change.
Yeah, it is. But I'm mostly excited to share it with people because it is like 95 minutes of work that makes me really, really, it's just juicy and delicious and funny and irreverent. And I think we all need that right now.
Right. Since we're getting to the end of our time, there's two questions, quick questions I usually ask at the end. I feel like there was so much more we could talk about. Is there anything that you really wanted to make sure we spoke about before we finish up that I didn't bring up? Oh, I know there's more we could have touched on, but anything that you really wanted to talk about today?
I think the only thing that I would say is one thing that I learned through this, like writing, coming to writing at this point, is ask Abbott for Costello. Like, ask people for things. Worst thing they can do is say no. Like, I do you know what I mean? Like, I think there's so much of like, I don't want to be rude. I don't want them to think I'm like, you know, but like, it's really surprising who will help you sometimes. Like, I ended up getting dinner with Martina Mayok of all people, because on the day I got the news about the commission, there was like a Lark get together and she was there. And she was so generous and like met with me and talked to me and like, she's so good and she has a Pulitzer. She's like busy. Like, you never know who might just say like, you know what, today's the day. I'm going to take this person out for coffee and talk to them about
the thing they're trying to do.
Exactly.
That's great advice. You know,
be audacious. Why not?
I love it. Okay. So if you are kind of in that dark place, uninspired place, are there any tangible things that you reach for again and again that kind of help pull you out of it, like books you reread or music you listen to or places you go, things like that?
Yes. The book Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert is really marvelous. There are sections where I'm like, Elizabeth, like, that's nonsense. Like, she'll be like, you can just get a group of friends together for free and start a writer's group. I'm like, Elizabeth, like, not always. But there are sections of that book, particularly where she talks about inspiration and ideas coming to you and like letting things flow through you, that are so valuable and lovely. Anna Deavere Smith's Letters to a Young Artist. There's an amazing, just like one paragraph chapter called Keeping the Faith. Cannot recommend it enough. And in terms of kind of, I like to have a playlist. I like to visualize on the subway. Like, I think it's nice, you know, at any given time to have a song or two that you come back to and just visualize what you want. And, you know, I don't like using the word manifesting lightly, because I know it has a very specific religious connotation, but the idea that when you picture something, we know this is true for athletes, right? You picture something and it's more likely that you'll be able to do it. So I really believe in that. And I mean, if you really want some like quick tingles, like some quick endorphins, I really recommend Aquarium by Camille Saint-Saëns. It's like from Carnival of the Animals, and it's like a 2-minute piece. It's really like just sparkly and fascinating and mysterious, and I recommend that.
Thank you. And then, is there any piece of art that you've taken in lately, a play, a book, a TV show, whatever, that you want to recommend?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, there are so many. I mean, for people who can go do things in person, who feel comfortable doing that right now, strapping on a K95 and being in a, there's so many wonderful things happening off Broadway right now. On Sugarland, New York Theater Workshop is like magical. Tambo and Bones, audacious. I just saw English, which is Sanaz Tusi's other play, at Atlantic. That is a really tender, Chekhovian, beautiful piece. I think if you are not in that place, things to watch on a screen or engage with on a screen. The book Mexican Gothic is like delicious and like just, it is gross also because it is a Gothic, but like it's so thrilling. It's so thrilling and escapist, and also somehow like taps into so many dark things about our real world. And let me think. I mean, there are some great audiobooks too. I always try to put those in. If you're feeling like, you know, like that way inclined, the Sally Rooney novels, you know, Conversations with Friends and Normal People. Mm-hmm. And I think even her newest one, they all have a marvelous Irish narrator. And those are such like complicated, sexy, like good books to read if you are just like interested in human nature. And like,
they sound very good for the winter too.
They are. They're perfect for winter. And they, there's just something about them. You don't feel alone listening to them because they're so honest and kind of messy and tender.
Wonderful. Nikki, thank you so much. I feel like this is a long time coming, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. This podcast has meant a lot to me and helped me through some hard times. So I'm really grateful to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please review and follow in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Monic Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.